Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over the green world?
Well, we bit the apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.
Yes, we did. We started to burn many things we found. That's the divine Darwin singing with Pete Seeger and Richard Burns of Rivertown Kids on the Tomorrow's Children Grammy-winning album, the Solartopia song. This is Harvey Wasserman with another Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Glad to have you with us. We have two great guests today. First will be Bob McChesney, author of Dollarocracy, and about to go on a big tour around the country for promoting his book. And in the second hour, we'll break it at 30. Come back after about 3 minutes, we'll have David Swanson, one of the great, energetic, brilliant, and articulate spokespersons for peace in the world today. I want to start, Bob, and keep you waiting for a minute, with a discussion of Fukushima. I've put up a piece on the internet and at the website nukefree.org, N-U-K-E-F-R-E-E.org. It's a blog there, and I've linked it to a petition at moveon.org. We're over 7,000 signatures after just 3-4 days. At various websites around the internet. The reality is this. Fukushima Unit 4 has a spent fuel pool 100 feet in the air, and this spent fuel pool is filled with the core of Unit 4, which was taken out of the reactor prior to the earthquake and tsunami. They, of course, didn't know the earthquake and tsunami were coming. This is a root maintenance. And the fact is that these about 400 tons of the most radioactive materials ever created are sitting in a spent fuel pool 100 feet in the air above Fukushima Unit 4. And this stuff, if it's exposed to air, if it loses coolant, will send an incredible radioactive cloud into the atmosphere. I'm sorry to be giving you such bad news here. But this is the reality of the situation. It could be happening at any moment. It's been a miracle that they've been able to maintain the coolant into this radioactive pool since 3/11/11, when the Fukushima earthquake and tsunami hit. But the reality is that the building, Unit 4, is crumbling and tilting. It's sinking into the ground because so much water has been pouring through the Fukushima site. The site is extremely unstable and in very difficult condition. So it's absolutely essential that this core, these fuel rods, be removed from the Unit 4 spent fuel pool. But the Tokyo Electric Power Company has announced that they're going to do this within 60 days, but they are completely incompetent. There's a former U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commissioner over there, Dale Klein, who has gone on record in a public statement saying that to TEPCO, you don't know what you are doing. And that's all too true, unfortunately. Our petition, which is at nukefree.org, freepress.org, Common Dreams, Counterpunch, a few other websites, is asking the Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, and President Obama to intervene in at Fukushima and to have a global international team of scientists and engineers to go in and take over this place. We can't trust the Tokyo Electric Power Company, which is, after all, a for-profit company, and we can't trust the government of Japan, which has an interest in covering up what's really happening there and which really doesn't have the resources to deal with this situation. So if you would go to nukefree.org, sign the petition at moveon@leaseovertomoveon.org. As I say, we've got over 7,000 signatures in just a few days. We will deliver these signatures to Ban Ki-moon and to President Obama. We have got to get a global force of engineers and scientists into Fukushima to supervise and coordinate bringing down the spent fuel pool. As I say, there's between 13 and 15,000 times more radiation tied up in the fuel rods at Fukushima than was released at Hiroshima. So, and of course, Fukushima is less than 200 miles from Tokyo. God forbid this should happen. Tokyo would have to be evacuated as if it would help, which really wouldn't help much at all, but there would be no choice. And so, and this radiation will come to the United States. God forbid if it happens. It took 4 days for radiation to arrive from Fukushima back in March of 2011. And it took less than a week. It took about 10 days for radiation to arrive from Chernobyl. We're looking here at essentially an apocalyptic event, if God forbid something should happen to these fuel rods. So please do sign our petition. Watch us closely at nukefree.org and here at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. I'm sure other hosts on PRN will be talking about it. It's something to take very, very seriously. So please do just that. Bob McChesney, are you with us?
I sure am, Harvey.
Okay, Bob, sorry to ruin your day.
Maybe. Well, all right. My day's more... not. Yeah, it could be worse for me, but it seems real bad for a lot of people.
Yes. Hope you will the petition at nukefree.org and circulate that. You have a tremendous reach on the Internet. We have great respect for the work you do. And if you'll consider spreading the URL, I'd greatly appreciate it. We're honored to have you on the show. You're about to go on tour with your book, Dollarocracy, you and John Nichols, co-authors. I've had you on before. Tell us about this tour and tell us what you hope to accomplish with that and with the book.
Well, the tour, actually, we already started it last week. We did New York, Philly, Baltimore, and D.C., and then next week we do New England, and then we do the West Coast and some Midwest places in between or thereafter. And the idea of the tour is to talk about the books, talk about the issues being raised, and use it as a movement-building moment also to get people energized, to get involved in working on politics in general, but politics specifically about getting the corporate domination of our politics to end.
All right, well, tell us, first of all, I'm intrigued. When you say you do New York, do Washington, do Philadelphia, that has various meanings in various circles. When you go to a town, what does it mean that you do the town?
Well, what we do, and John and I do organize the tour ourselves. We don't have anyone who does it for us. I mean, it's our work. And what we do is we find a city that can bring us in and organize us. We want to do a public event in the evening. And once we get one of those locked in, and then we try to find nearby towns that we can do so we can do 3 or 4 days in a row. And then we fill up our daytime with, we usually try to find local schools or colleges or activist group that want us to come in and give a talk. So we try to do 3 or 4 events a day with one major public event in the evening.
And the two of you travel together?
Yeah, we're a team.
Okay, and so in New York, for example, where did you speak? How many people did you speak to? Give us your day in New York.
Sure. The first day of the tour, we went to Fordham at Lincoln Center and talked to about 40 or 50 people at midday. Then we went to NYU for a late afternoon event and probably talked to about 50 or 60 people. And then we walked over to Judson Memorial Church on Washington Square Park and did a fundraiser for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting based on the books. And the book was given away along with Jeremy Scahill and Amy Goodman. And we probably drew, I'm guessing, around 300 people. And so that was the first day of the tour.
Fantastic. Amy Goodman's always a big draw, of course.
And, and Jeremy, too. I mean, they're both phenomenal speakers.
Uh-huh. And then in Philadelphia, what did you do in Philadelphia?
Philly, we just were there for during the day. We did Penn at lunchtime, and then we did Temple late afternoon. Then we got on the train and went down to Baltimore and did a big event with Red Emma's Bookstore Collective and Mark Steiner that night on Tuesday night in Philly, in Baltimore, I mean. And then Wednesday was American University and a big evening event at George Washington University with U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders on the DS with us. So
now Bernie Sanders, he wrote the NOD book, is that right?
He did indeed. He's been someone we've worked with for a very long time, since, you know, for a couple decades. And we talked to him a lot. He's been unquestionably, of all the members in Congress, the one who's been most centrally concerned with what's taking place with our media system and the role of corporations and big money to produce a crappy media system. And I think it's fair to say he's probably the one who's been most obsessed with what's happened to the election system in the country, too. So he wrote the foreword to the book, Dollarocracy, for us. He's someone who we've worked closely with over the years and will continue to do so in the future.
Yeah, he's a very cool guy, Bernie Sanders. He's been senator. Is this, what, his second or third term now from Vermont?
He just got elected his second term in the Senate last year. But before that, he served 8 terms in the U.S. House and then 10 years as mayor of Burlington, Vermont before that.
Yeah, he's quite an amazing guy, Bernie Sanders. And, of course, it's a big deal that he wrote the intro to your book. It gives it a lot of weight, a lot of gravitas, as they say. A very proud thing. So if people want to bring you in to their city, how do they contact you? You and John do all this organizing yourself? I mean,
pretty much, yeah.
Well, that's a heck of a lot of organizing.
Well, you know, I suspect, Harvey, you would agree with me that when you work hard and you write a book and you want, it's important to you and you think it's got an important message, writing the book's about half the work. The other half is getting the ideas out there, talking about them, having the work have some effect in the world. So we take the organizing part after the book's done as seriously as we do the research and writing before the book is finished. And that's why we do what we do. And, you know, I think we're pretty much tapped out for places we can go in 2013, but if someone just, I'm on, if you just Google my name, you'll find me all over the internet. You can find a way to email me through my university website. I'm easy to find. We'll love to maybe do events in the future, but I got to warn you, we are booked solid this year. And then, unfortunately, we both have day jobs, which are going to make it more difficult to travel come next year.
So what is your day job? This is Robert McChesney. Spell your name so people can find you easily.
Sure. It's McChesney. If you just look up Dollarocracy on the internet, you'll see my name, and I'm very easy to find online. In my day job, I'm a college professor at the University of Illinois. I teach communication.
In Champaign.
That's right.
Okay, very good. And the book, who published the book?
The book was published by Nation Books in New York.
Okay, very good. All right, so tell us, give us a message now. I know you've been on before, but when you speak to a crowd, what do you tell them?
Well, we basically summarize much of the book and the argument we make, the evidence that we have. And what we try to do is, I think that everyone understands that our governing system has become very corrupt and ineffectual. I think most people understand what the evidence shows is that our governing system, our Congress, our regulators respond quickly and aggressively to the needs of the very wealthiest Americans and have virtually no interest in the needs of anyone else. This isn't a polemical point I'm making. This has actually been confirmed in the research by political scientists. I think most Americans get it. And I think there's a sense of despair that most Americans have, unless they're in the top 1%, with their governing system, and a frustration. So we try to explain why that is. We try to explain the long-term historical battles that got us to this point, the right-wing campaign to neuter democracy that's been going on for 40 years now, and how successful they've been, and then put the nature of elections and the Citizens United decision in that context. So it's not just some sort of oddball thing that just happened, but it's part of a broader historical context and a much broader political fight.
Okay, so we're talking with Robert McChesney, co-author with John Nichols of Dollarocracy, published by Nation Books. It's a depressing message. Why do you date it 40 years? What happened 40 years ago that has been different? I mean, we've had in American democracy right from the writing a constitution, the effort of the rich to stay rich and the poor get poorer. What happened 40 years ago to change the scene here?
Well, I think to really be simplify without hopefully being too simplistic, you know, the United States, there has been an ongoing struggle from the beginning to expand the franchise, to make the nation more genuinely democratic. The beginning of the country, I think, less than 10%, it might have even been close to 5 or 6% of Americans, adults, were eligible to be citizens and to vote, I mean, to be participants in the political process. And we've struggled basically all the way from 1787 or 1789 to 1971 or two before we had genuine universal adult suffrage in this country. So it took us almost 200 years to become the country that a lot of us are taught we were in 1789 or 1776. And those were always tough fights. I mean, people with property have always been scared about the idea of extending the franchise to those who weren't in the ruling circles for fear that they'd be outnumbered. And what happened in the United States by 1970 was, I think between roughly 1900 or 1910 and 1970, this country had a number of major reforms that were a result of political organizing. It was by no means one victory after another, but it wasn't like the way people regard politics today, in which the corporate interests always win, big money always wins. In fact, if you look going back to the Progressive Era through the New Deal into the 1960s, there were a number of stunning victories, some of which we still enjoy the benefits of today, which made this country much more egalitarian than it had been, which made it a much better country than it had been, a more democratic country. Social Security, the right to have labor unions, Medicare, Voting Rights Act, environmental protections such as they were. Right on down the list, end of child labor, women getting the vote, elected U.S. Senate. All these things were the result of popular struggles that made them possible. And I think by the end of the 1960s or early 1970s, and Harvey, I know you and I both go back to this era, the people who sat atop American society, the traditional rulers, the wealthy, powerful interests, the business CEOs, looked at the way American society was going and didn't like what they saw at all. They saw someone like Ralph Nader is regarded as the most popular person in the country by people in both political parties. They saw young people on college campuses, middle-class kids, who traditionally in every society are the backbone of conservatism and pro-business sentiment in the society, decidedly hostile to corporations and business and to business values. And increasing percentage of young people saying, you know, maybe having businesses run the society doesn't make a lot of sense. It's time to get past that to something better. And one person in particular who was especially alarmed by this was one of the leading corporate lawyers in the country. And he was commissioned by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to write a confidential memo to CEOs and billionaires and multimillionaires about how they should react to this political problem that they saw, this crisis. His name was Lewis Powell. He was the lawyer for the tobacco industry. And he wrote a memo, basically a short memo, and it's available online if you go to just Google Lewis Powell memo. And he wrote a memo for the CEO saying it's time for business to take over the government again. We've sort of let it get astray. It's been a little got too carried away with this democracy thing with poor people and African Americans and women and students and young people getting too interested in politics. We have to return them to the couch and have business take over the country, as has been the traditional way it's worked in this country. And Powell laid out a platform of basically taking over, you know, making the media and higher education much more sympathetic to big business, doing a PR blitz, starting groups like who would become the Heritage Foundation and Cato, ALEC, the American Legislative and Exchange Council, all grew out of this. Powell also strongly urged big business to, you know, triple, quintuple its spending on lobbying and politics. And after that memo came out and was distributed, we saw a tenfold increase in corporate lobbying in Washington, D.C. Within the next 10 or 20 years. It basically changed the nation's city and invented something called K Street. So this is really, this counter-revolution began then to really make America a right-wing, inegalitarian country as it had been in the Gilded Age. That started then. And interestingly enough, Lewis Powell's, one of his biggest arguments was it was crucial for the right wing and corporate interests to take over the courts, that the court system had allowed sort of even people you thought were going to be good, like Earl Warren, once they got on the court, they sort of became liberals. And this is something they couldn't allow to continue. They needed to develop a farm club and make sure that the judges, when they got put in the court, would be their guys. They'd be hardcore right-wingers. And as fate would have, or not right-wingers is the wrong term, because Powell wasn't regarded as a right-winger. He was regarded as a moderate. And in those days, being a moderate for a white Southerner simply meant you weren't in the Klan. And so he was a moderate white Southerner. But when he was appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court, as some of the listeners should well know, 2 months after he wrote this memo. And he went to the court, and his whole era on the court, over a decade, his number one issue was having unlimited corporate and millionaire spending on elections. It was his central passion in life, was making it possible for rich people to buy elections. And, you know, the ACLU crowd, some of them will say, well, gee, that Lewis Powell just loved freedom so much. He just loved the idea that people could have freedom. And that's why he wanted to let everyone spend as much as they want to have freedom. Well, that was baloney. If you read the Powell memo, it's obvious. He saw it purely in class terms. He wanted rich people to buy elections because he knew that he had trouble winning them in a fair fight. And that was his mission. So that memo, that period, is the moment we've been in since then.
That's an amazing wrap. I can see why Bob McChesney, people come hear you, very articulate. And of course, the Powell memo came out, and as you point out in your book, Dollarocracy, John Roberts is the current Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, is the direct inheritor of the Lewis Powell memo, and the corporatization of the court system, I guess, is how we best put it. And of course, that memo also came out in the midst and in the aftermath of the Vietnam War, which allowed Richard Nixon to just run rampant through our political system.
Well, you know, John Roberts, as you said, he is the heir apparent to Lewis Powell. He's a complete charlatan and political hack, and he should be regarded as such. He wrote his opinion in Citizens United. He probably wrote that years before he ever joined the Supreme Court. He's been, like Lewis Powell, singularly obsessed with two or three things since taking over as Chief Justice 8 years ago. One has been unlimited billionaire and corporate spending on elections. Two is eliminating or lessening any of the ability of labor unions to exist or to operate politically. And three, his other obsession is making it easier for states to suppress the vote, such hence the voting rights decision this summer. He is Dollarocracy's champion, like they've never had before, and trying to do everything in his power to guarantee that rich people will run this country and democracy will not get in their way. And Lewis Powell must be looking up and smiling from wherever he is at what John Roberts has done.
Let's hope he's rotting in hell and can't see up. But nonetheless, this also fits into the drug war. You know, the drug war, which began in earnest with Richard Nixon in the, 1970, has been a major vehicle in disenfranchising people and allowing the corporations to continue their power. We see, those of us who are optimists, see the drug war winding down. How do you fit all that into the into this Powell-Roberts corporatization of the court system?
Well, I think you've already, in your question, really sort of got right at what the answer is to some extent, which is that, you know, if your idea is to minimize people from voting who will not support your politics, the drug war has had the delicious effect of making millions of people, largely non-white, significantly African-American men, felons, and that means in 39 states they are never allowed to vote even after they've done their time. And that is millions of people. That's the difference between, you know, who wins and loses elections in a lot of places, including the presidential election. And so that, you know, that is, that's done wonders. You know, Michelle Alexander, as you know, wrote the book The New Jim Crow. Well, in effect, had that way effect of reducing the black voting base dramatically in 39 states, and even all 50 when you just look at people in prison, too. So it's had that effect. I think also the drug war, because it basically creates sort of a boogeyman and sort of a demon, is really good for sort of right-wing politicians because they love nothing more than to whip people into hysterical fear. That's the best way they operate. And drug wars and sort of these sort of scare campaigns are very good for that.
So what are they going to use to substitute? You know, the drug war clearly, at least where marijuana is concerned, is starting to wind down. It's way beyond their power now. You got two states where it's legal. I'm sure it'll be legal in California and most of the New England states, if not all of them, within 2 or 4 years. What's going to substitute for the drug war?
Well, you know, I think the drug war isn't the only thing that's been used to sort of whip people into a frenzy. I think the war on terror and general chauvinism, international chauvinism, has always been a good mechanism, too. But at the same time, and I think what your question is getting at is that one of the things about America that my research has demonstrated when I was doing the work on this book for the last few years is the United States is no longer or is not as much of a right-wing or conservative country as it was in the past. Now, this country's population is decidedly more progressive, I think, on a number of political issues. And it's certainly, there's no evidence that it has moved to the right in the same way that both our political parties have in the last generation. I think the movement of our political parties to the right reflects the movement of big money to dominate them, not the sentiments or concerns of the American people. And what's happened in America, especially in the last 10 or 15 years, is that the gap between where the political parties are, where our news media pundits are, and where the bulk of the American people are has grown larger and larger, especially among younger Americans, especially among Americans of color. I think we're at a point now where people in power are deeply concerned about their ability to continue to run the country as they have. And I think that explains, Harvey, why you see in cases like Citizens United and all this new voter suppression that's taking place in state after state after state, that there's a desperate fear by the wealthy, powerful interests in this country, by corporations, by CEOs, by the Koch brothers, that they're going to lose this country if it remains too democratic. They've got to really make it easier to buy elections, repress voter turnout, get it even lower than it's been. We're the lowest in the world already. And basically make sure the political system can't get in the way of what their traditional control of society. That's the fight we have now. And the encouraging part of that is that I think they recognize something we ought to recognize, that we've got the numbers on our side. They're the ones who are desperate. They seem to have all the power. They seem to have us completely outfoxed and boxed in and powerless. But, in fact, we have the numbers, and if we understand that and act strategically, we're in a position to be more successful today than progressive forces have been in a couple of generations.
All right, beautifully said. Robert McChesney, Dollarocracy is the book. It's from Nation Books. You can contact Rob and get him to come to your town in 2014, if you're lucky enough. Extremely articulate and important stuff, and we're going to follow you. Hopefully you'll come back on the show. And do please take a look at the petition at nukefree.org about Fukushima. You've got a tremendous network, and we can certainly use your help on that. This is the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Bob, thank you so much for being with us. We're going to take a short break with the Solartopia song, the Rocky Top version by Dan Lyons, and come back with David Swanson. Bob, keep in touch and take care.
Sure thing, Harvey. Give my best to David. He does great work, too.
Okay, take care.
Oil refineries, pipelines, mega dams. Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan. Oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam. Road rage, asthma, famine, leukemia, it's time to get a better plan. Sweet home to me, Solartopia, that's the future for me, green-powered energy, windmills, hydrogen, photovoltaic cells with solar panels everywhere, solar cars, fast trains, bicycles, hydroplanes, get you home in under an hour.
All right, the wonderful Dana Lyons singing the Rocky Top version of the Solartopia song. We're back for another half hour with the great David Swanson. We've had been visited by, honored by Robert McChesney, co-author with John Nichols of Dollarocracy. And now we have with us David Swanson, truly one of the most energetic, articulate, indefatigable, and apparently inexhaustible, David Swanson. David, are you with us?
Hi, Harvey. Good to be here.
Well, it's good to have you, man. And let's talk, first of all, you and I both wrote celebratory articles. Rare we get to do that. But, you know, I think we were both wise enough in this case to take a moment to celebrate the fact that we are not bombing Syria. It's a small victory. It's a temporary victory, no doubt. It's full of caveats and all that stuff. But let's bask in it for a moment. What do you think about Barack Obama's backing off his, at least for the time being, his bombing of Syria?
Well, I don't think he backed off. I think we backed him off. I think the people of the United States and of the world said no and had an impact. And I think that the efforts of people over the past years and decades to push back against war have had an impact in moving people's understanding, so that despite the smaller crowds at events these days, we have more people with us in the polls in the United States and around the world than in many years. We have a return of that evil sickness known as the Vietnam syndrome, that is to say, healthy resistance to war making. And this was popular. This was popular pressure that did this and nothing else. So I don't want to rest on our laurels or bask in the enjoyment of having achieved world peace. We're nowhere close, and the threat is still there, and they haven't sent in the missiles, but they're sending in the guns and so forth. But there's a reluctance by too many people to declare victories and take credit, and the government won't do it for us. And I think this is a huge one. I mean, we've been hearing from people for years and years, you can't stop a war. You can't, you cannot block any proposed war that they want, and, which is, you know, logically that's always been false. We always could if we just did more. But now you can laugh at that with the ability to point to an example and say, here, look, the Raytheon's stock was through the roof. People were fleeing Syria in greater numbers. The world understood the missiles were about to fly. And we stopped them. And John Kerry, yes, he mumbled something about if Assad hands over the chemical weapons, he can prevent a war. But when people began taking that seriously and Russia called his bluff and said, yeah, let's do it, and Syria immediately said, sure, we'll do it, then Kerry put out a statement that said, I was just being rhetorical. I didn't mean it. Don't get in the way of our war. And then when it was clear that even the Senate, not just the House, but the Senate would reject any such measure, then Kerry said, oh, actually, I did mean it. I think it has a good chance of succeeding. So he was for it after he was against it, after he was for it. But that was because of public pressure. It was because, you know, why did the White House accept the deal? Never mind Syria and Russia accepting the deal. What, the White House accepted the deal because Congress said no, and they were forced to go to Congress by our work demanding it, by Congress members demanding it, and by the House of Commons in Britain saying no for the first time in centuries, and the governments of the world, with the possible exception of France, saying, go Dick Cheney yourself, because we're not going to be part of this one.
That's a great phrase, go Dick Cheney yourself. I think you ought to trademark that one, kind of like three-peat, you know. That's fantastic. Well, I want to remind people, and before we get too far afield, David, I know you're way too young to remember the Vietnam War, but, you know, I marched against the Vietnam War starting in 1965. People first started burning their draft cards, thankfully. And people have told us, oh, your marching was futile. The people of Vietnam won the war. You know, the people of Vietnam clearly did win that war. But Richard Nixon, where is he now that we need him, in his autobiography did concede, in a footnote, by God, that he wanted to use nuclear weapons in Vietnam, and he was dissuaded by what he knew would happen in the streets. So anyone who ever really has second thoughts about going out and marching against a war, just remember that Dick Nixon, go Dick Nixon yourself, would have nuked Vietnam if it hadn't been for us out there in the streets. So tell us, David, this victory here in Syria, it really comes in the people's victory. It really comes in the frame of the 10-year insanity dating back to 2013 when George W. Bush ignored us all, ignored 15 million people marching worldwide against going into Iraq. What's different now than 10 years ago?
Well, you say ignored us all, but some, roughly half the country, depending on how the poll was done, wanted to attack Iraq. And it wasn't until a year and a half into the occupation of Iraq that you begin to have the polls say, we never should have done that. It was a bad idea. It was a mistake. We're against it. And that continued for years and years as the occupation rolled on. And of course, if you asked people, do you want to end it? They didn't necessarily want to end it just because they wished it had never started, because you can't end a war without unsupporting the troops. And so it's always much better to prevent a war beginning in the first place than deal with the patriotic insanity of needing to kill more people for the benefit of the people you already killed. You know, even when suicide is the top killer of your troops, you know, they must keep killing themselves so that the other people didn't kill themselves in vain, and you just can't stop the train. But if you prevent it ever leaving the station, you're better off. So here we are with much smaller rallies, much smaller activity, the peace groups having been defunded and demobilized by the election of Democrats, but the polls overwhelmingly with us across the political spectrum, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, the Pope, Rush Limbaugh, everybody on our side on this one. And yes, there were Republicans who opposed the war because the president is a Democrat. That's clearly a worthy suspicion here. But there were also Democrats who openly said, I mean, Democratic Congress members who openly said they wanted to support it because the president was a Democrat. So that went both ways. And you had the bipartisan agreement among the leadership of the two parties in Washington, in both houses and the White House, like you always do. You know, never mind these myths about gridlock. When it comes to big things, there is harmony among the leadership. But you had the Congress members of both parties, the rank and file, say no to their leaders and openly admit that the calls and the emails and the visits were coming in 100-1, 200-1 against, that this was a level of public pressure and a one-sidedness of public pressure and an intensity of public pressure that they'd never seen before, not even, you know, opposing the bank bailouts and certainly not opposing past wars. So this war might not have been worse than the others had it gotten going, might have been worse, might have been better, might have been catastrophically worse, but the public sentiment against it was far superior beforehand. And this is what I wanted when I wrote a book called War is a Lie, laying out the lies to prepare people for the next war marketing campaign to come, was that we would be against a war before it started. And you should remember, as of course you do, Harvey, that we have the transcript of Henry Kissinger telling Richard Nixon to think about using nuclear bombs and not be worried about it. And who did John Kerry meet in the crisis situation of struggling to sell the war on Syria but Henry Kissinger? So some things don't change.
Yes, and we've got to remember that Henry Kissinger, people need to know this about Henry Kissinger. He was working actually for the Johnson campaign and made a secret phone call in 1968 to the Nixon campaign suggesting that they sabotage the peace talks in 1968 between the North and South Vietnamese so that the war could continue long enough to defeat Hubert Humphrey in the very close election of 1968, give us Richard Nixon 7 more years of war, and then, of course, Kissinger winds up as Secretary of State and Nixon's chief advisor. We're talking with David Swanson, truly great peace activist, prolific, articulate, and always on point. David, you've got a piece up today. Can you tell us about that one?
What was it called? Was it about Congress members?
Yes, this is you came out and compared a Republican in your, I guess he's in your district or near your district in Charlottesville, Virginia, you and Dave Matthews and Thomas Jefferson, all from the same town, and you pointed out how the Democrat was a warmonger, and the Republican had serious questions about the war. You want to get a little more explicit about that?
Yeah, I mean, this district may be extreme, but this is rural Virginia. Charlottesville is a progressive university town, but it's in a district that's bigger than the state of New Jersey. It's rural Virginia. It's on the line between horrible, horrible Republicans and horrible, horrible Democrats that we switch back and forth between as our representatives or misrepresentatives in Congress. And when Obama was elected, this district voted out a Republican incumbent, a longtime embarrassment named Virgil Goode, and put in Tom Perriello, a so-called progressive Democrat, who everybody still thinks of as a great progressive Democrat and who now runs the Center for American Progress, who's been involved in starting up Avaaz, which is a huge international online activist group that is rather pro-humanitarian war. If you don't know what humanitarian wars are, they are wars where you bomb people because you care about them. And so you have these bizarre arguments between the libertarians who don't want to bomb Syrians because the Syrians aren't worth it, and the humanitarian warriors who want to bomb Syrians because they love Syrians as much as any other human beings. And this is who Tom Perriello is. So people just reflexively, thoughtlessly, peace activists, went and elected this Democrat. And then we went and met with him and talked with him and protested. And it was like talking to a brick wall about funding Afghanistan. And of course, he was at the mercy of the Democrats. He won by less than one percentage point with a huge media buy by the Democratic National Committee. And so when they had this emergency funding of Afghanistan and Iraq in 2009, as if it were some sort of emergency, but off the books funding, he wanted to vote yes, of course, and we argued against it. And then when his party's leadership put in a bailout for Eastern European bankers into the same bill for no apparent reason, and the Republicans all decided to vote no, even though it was a war bill, because they didn't want to do that, then his vote was needed. And this was down to the wire. It was going to pass or fail by one vote. And the DNC bought him radio ads. They threatened, it's almost certainly clear that they threatened to challenge him in the next election. And they sent Van Jones, a White House environmental guy, down to Charlottesville to do an event with him. And they sent a couple more cabinet secretaries down to the university to do events with him. And all of these bribes and threats, and he voted for it. So he voted for every war dollar put before him. He never listened to us. He then, when Obama was no longer God in 2010, got voted out, and we've had this Republican, Robert Hurt, for the past term and a half, and we went and flooded his office with demands and visits, and he met with us, and we talked to him about Syria, and he said all the right things, and he agreed with us, and he agreed on principle that he was against wars of this sort, wars that were not about national security. So now, you know, whatever person the Democrats put up against him next time is almost certain to be better than him on lots of issues, right? I mean, he wants the Keystone Pipeline to get us off the foreign oil, to get us onto the local oil. You know, he's going to be horrible on all sorts of issues. But war is the big thing our government does. It's half the budget. It dwarfs anything else. You can't be for schools and for a $1 trillion military with wars. I mean, it just doesn't work. And so I think we have to think carefully about how we prioritize parties and how we prioritize people that we can get to listen to us on important things.
Well, we're talking with David Swanson, a tremendous speech activist. War is a Lie is his seminal book here, and that's the name of your website, I believe. David, I want to throw in a little commercial here and ask you, you were actually the first to immediately respond with our petition to put in an international force to take over at Fukushima. We are petitioning the United Nations and President Obama. Obviously, a situation as desperate as it is at Fukushima can't be handled by a private utility or even a single country, even if it's Japan. And thank you so much. You responded immediately. We now have over 7,000 signatures at the Move On site. It's linked through nuke3.org, and I really appreciate you jumping on that, a tremendously important situation. Now, David, as a peace activist, I want to ask you, what has changed specifically? You've laid out a beautiful case here. That's why I wanted to bring up that piece showing an anti-war. I guess anti-war is a bit radical for this Republican that you're talking about versus the pro-war, Republican versus the pro-war Democrat. What is going forward now when the next war comes forward? You know, something has changed in the American psyche in the last 10 years. The horror of Iraq, the insanity of Afghanistan, and it led us to avoid, at least for the time being, more of the same in Syria. They're going to come at us again. How do we go about stopping the next war, and in fact preventing Obama from going ahead and doing it in Syria, you know, down the road?
Well, I think we've shown remarkable ability to say no to a war when asked. That is, when they give us some warning that they're going to market a new war. And yes, they did a horrible job of it, and they could do a better job in the future. They could bother to try to scare us. They could bother to make it, quote-unquote, defensive. They could put up a better salesman than John Kerry. But we've shown remarkable ability. We have to maintain that skepticism, that willingness to reject a new war, regardless of who the president is or how new or old he is. I think, you know, that we've shown we're in a very good place, at least for the moment, if we can stay there. The problem is that most wars now are not announced at all. There were a large number of people killed by a U.S. drone strike today in Pakistan. Nobody was asked. Nobody went to the Congress or the public and said, should we buzz these drones over people's houses in Pakistan without end, threatening annihilation moment after moment for weeks, and then blow people up? Should we do it in Yemen? Should we do it in Somalia? Nobody asks, and so there's no process of congressional debate, no public input, no resistance, no discussion of it as a war with an on and off switch. And that's what's going on in Afghanistan. There's this pretense and this widespread belief that it's ended or it's ending, whatever that means, for it to be ending year after year. And we have this major war ongoing in Afghanistan, and it's just sort of out of our minds. And with Syria, when the missiles weren't sent in, the guns were sent in. And you had Senator Corker from Tennessee endlessly talking about how the United States is covertly supplying arms to the rebels in Syria, as if they were Syrian and as if you could talk about it and have it be covert. I don't know if the senator understands what that means, but the CIA is sending arms and training and otherwise assisting foreign fighters and Syrians in attacking their government in Syria. And that's war, and that's illegal, and it's immoral, and it's catastrophic. And there actually were polls done quite a lot some weeks back on this, and the American public was even more against this than against the missile strikes. So yeah. it's not as if something more acceptable got chosen. So I think we have to up our game. We have to take the momentum we had last week and 2 weeks ago and say, look, we did something. Get your brothers and your sisters and your friends and your neighbors to join in. We got something more to do, and get the Congress to tell the CIA that it cannot participate in this war in Syria. I mean, that can be done, and there's nothing to wait for, and people can go to rootsaction.org right now and do it.
Well, we're talking with David Swanson, a great piece out, Chris. I want to be on record as saying that I think that moment where John Kerry slipped his tongue and said that if Assad turned in his chemical weapons, we wouldn't attack, and he tried to rescind it, I think that was due to an acid flashback from the 1960s. I do remember John Kerry throwing his medals over a fence, although I think he later denied it. But nonetheless, you know, I think it was an LSD flashback that got us out of it, giving us another great reason to be thankful for LSD, since it did, in fact, bring us the computer revolution. Apple, Microsoft, all that stuff was done under the influence. David, do you think that the fact that Barack Obama, allegedly a liberal who voted against Iraq, what do you think the difference is in any of this between Barack Obama and George W. Bush?
Well, let's be careful with our LSD-influenced myths here. Barack Obama was lucky enough not to yet be in Congress for the vote on Iraq. This is how he avoided voting for the war on Iraq. All of the senators who were in the Senate at the time that there was a vote on attacking Iraq and who wanted to be president were told by all their super smart advisors that they would have to vote yes if they ever wanted to be president. And so this is how Kerry and Hillary Clinton and everyone who was there voted. Howard Dean, who also was frequently given credit for having voted no, was never in the Senate, and this is how he avoided voting yes. So Barack Obama, you know, gave a very mild anti-war speech in which he opposed dumb wars and favored fighting smarter wars. He then campaigned for the White House on a horrendous platform of lowering corporate taxes and everything across the spectrum of issues, and a larger military, a military presence in more countries, drone strikes into Pakistan, an escalation of the war in Afghanistan, and smart wars instead of dumb wars. He then was given a Nobel Peace Prize in which he, for the first time in the history of that prize, gave a pro-war speech, denounced and disagreed with the positions of a previous laureate, namely Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and sent everyone a clear signal that he was in favor of wars. It's not a question of our needing to replace him with someone who isn't. It's not so much, as the great Howard Zinn used to say, who's in the White House, who's sitting in the White House, as who is doing the sit-ins.
Exactly.
We need to force this guy right now, tomorrow, to talk to the president of Iran. I mean, this is what Obama admitted to the Atlantic magazine, what Senator McCain and his gang say openly. It's all about overthrowing the government of Iran and overthrowing the government of Syria as a step in that direction. The president has a new president in Iran who wants to talk to him, who is open to negotiations, as Iran has long been, and they are both going to be in the city of New York on Tuesday, and they ought to sit down and talk, because talking worked so incredibly well the moment that they had to go to Congress on the missile strikes and Congress was going to say no. They then decided, oh, we have the option of talking. Well, you always have that option. You don't have to wait for a crisis and a rejection. You can grab it and move ahead with it right away.
Well, we're talking with David Swanson here, one of the few to have the good sense to at least sit back and enjoy for a moment the victory that we had preventing Barack Obama from bombing Syria. We did, and your piece, I think, your most recent piece comparing a pro-war Democrat, shall we, for the time being at least, an anti-war Republican, was quite instructive. We have to remember that in the 20th century, every Democrat who was elected to, on the pretense of ending war, got us into one. And the one Republican who did the opposite was Dwight Eisenhower, who ran in 1952 under the slogan, "I will go to Korea." He actually went to Korea and actually ended the Korean War. What a concept. So, David, how do we sustain this? We just have a couple of minutes left. How do we sustain this as a public, as a grassroots movement, to put a permanent stop to all this military madness?
Well, we got to get control of it, and it has to be public. It has to be transparent and debatable. I don't know to what extent Eisenhower was supportive, but it was under his reign that the CIA overthrew the government of Iran, replaced a democracy with a monarchy, went to Guatemala, did the same thing, and started getting this idea that it didn't need to ask anybody's permission, possibly not even the president's, to go and overthrow governments. And so this has become U.S. policy. We like governments, we'll arm them. We don't like governments, we'll overthrow them. And if we can't do it secretly and quietly, we'll do it with a big war. We need to get control of this secret government. President Obama has given and the CIA the power to wage wars with flying robots and missiles. This needs to end. We need war to be something that Congress must declare, and then we need Congress to never declare it, and in fact to recognize treaties on the books like the Kellogg-Briand Pact that ban it. And this is a huge step in that distant direction, this victory over the proposal to send missiles into Syria that was just a little bit too crazy for the vast majority of us.
Well, very good, David, and you've been instrumental in that. War is a Crime is your website, is that correct?
Yeah, warisacrime.org. That's a good place to go.
And your book, your seminal book, what's your most recent book after War is a Crime?
Well, I have. The book was "War Is a Lie," as you got it right earlier, which most people always mix those two up. But I have a new book coming out next week or so with a foreword by Kathy Kelly that's just terrific, and the book is called "War No More: The Case for Abolition."
Absolutely. Well, great talking with you, David. It's an honor, and please, I thank you so much for your help with the Fukushima petition. This is Harvey Wasserman from the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Do go to newfree.org and see this petition for us to take over, have the United Nations, the United States, and all the world scientific and engineering community take over at Fukushima before they completely obliterate Japan with radioactive material that will come here. Thank you so much, David Swanson. Thank you, Bob McChesney. Thank you, crew in New York at the PRN headquarters, PRN.fm. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us. We'll see you next week for another Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show.
So we had to work to pay the cost, and so we went digging into the